Hello and welcome to Teaching, Learning, and Everything Else, a series of conversations with innovative educators at colleges and universities across the country. I'm Elizabeth Yost Hammer, Director of the Center for the Advancement of Teaching at Xavier University of Louisiana. And now, let's talk about teaching, learning, and everything else. Hello, my guest today is Brian Seville. He's an associate professor in the Department of Psychology at James Madison University in Harrisonburg, Virginia, where he has been since the fall of 2004. Prior to joining the faculty at JMU, he was an assistant professor in the Department of Psychology at Stephen S. Austin State University in Texas. He earned a BA in psychology from the University of Minnesota, his master's in applied psychology from St. Cloud State University, and a PhD in experimental psychology from Auburn University. In 2002, he received the McKeachy Early Career Award from the Society for the Teaching of Psychology. Although he has taught numerous courses over the past few years, he currently teaches general psych and psychological research methods. His primary research interests are in the teaching of psychology, the experimental analysis of social behavior, and the application of psychological principles to sport, health, and exercise. Dr. Seville, thank you very much for joining me today.
Well, thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Good. I'm excited about our topic today. We're going to be speaking about interteaching, which you are an expert on and have done a lot with. And so let's get started. I thought we could start by just, if you could just tell us, what is interteaching?
Interteaching is a new teaching method, a multi-component teaching method that actually has its roots in B.F. Skinner's behavior analysis, or operant psychology as it's sometimes called. Interteaching is actually a method that was developed by a professor by the name of Phil Heinlein up at Temple University. He'd been developing it over the course of a number of years, and then he and a colleague named Ted Boyce published a paper on it in 2002. I read that paper early on and became very interested in it, and contacted Phil and talked a little bit about interteaching and incorporated it in my classes fairly soon after that. Having an experimental psychology background, I was kind of the belief that, you know, just because my students enjoyed it doesn't mean I should continue to use it. And so fairly shortly after that, my colleagues and I started doing some research on it, and we've been doing research on various aspects of interteaching for, well, I would say maybe about the last 8 to 10 years. But the way interteaching works is, just to give you sort of a quick summary here, prior to each class period, students complete what I call a prep guide or a preparation guide. It's a, sort of a study guide that the instructor puts together that has a variety of questions which are written to guide the students through a particular reading assignment. And then when students come to class, what they do is they get into pairs, and they spend probably about two-thirds of the class period discussing their answers to those prep guide items. During the discussions, the instructor walks around, answers questions, sort of guides discussion, and then after students are done with their discussions, they turn in a record sheet that has several pieces of information, including who they worked with, how well the discussion went, and any items that were particularly hard to understand. And then what the instructor does is, at the start of the next class period, uses the record sheets to put together a brief clarifying lecture that maybe lasts about a third of the class period and really targets those items that students had a hard time with during the discussion. And then students, after that, move on to the next discussion. So that's sort of a brief summary of, if that was brief summary of interteaching.
Interesting. As I'm hearing you describe that, I wonder, do you think it, you know, and I'm thinking about you being at JMU and the kind of students you might have, do you think that this is a pedagogy that can be used at any level of student, any level of student preparation? I mean, do you think that it could fit in any,
yeah,
any discipline or any class?
I'm of the belief that principles of learning function regardless of where you are and what the particular topic is that you're studying. I know that since we published our first few studies, there have been replications in a variety of other disciplines, food science, nursing, I believe, religion, sociology, and they've all pretty much found the same thing. Here at JMU, I know that I've used it with a variety of classes, everything from introductory psychology up to graduate level courses. I've received emails and phone calls from people over the years who, you know, have used it in high school classes and said that it works very well. I think it's probably a matter of making sure that the prep guide items are written in such a way that you are producing the kind of discussion and thinking that you would like your students to do.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, for instance, a lot of people will say, well, I bet it works really well in an abnormal psychology class where, you know, you have a lot of interesting things to discuss, and I bet it doesn't work so well in statistics. And my wife, Tracy Zinn, has been doing or using inner teaching in her stats classes, and she says that it just works phenomenally well. And so a lot of that is, you know, how do you write the questions to get students to discuss the way you want? And maybe another way to think about it is, you know, in a typical stats course, students may not be doing a lot of discussing or may not necessarily see, you know, how the topic is related to their personal lives or what have you. And so by writing the questions in such a way that you get that discussion, I think it would be very useful in many different types of classes.
And so how do you write the questions? Like, if you had to give just a few concrete tips of somebody who wanted to implement this for the first time, how do you write good questions?
Right.
I mean, not telling them what their objectives are for the course, but how do you write questions to match
right.
those objectives?
I use a lot of the classic Bloom's taxonomy, where I think about questions where, you know, the first questions on a prep guide may simply ask them to, you know, define some terms. Next questions then might ask them to, you know, identify. So you just previously you defined a term. Now go into the scenario and tell me if you can identify what particular concept is operating here. You know, then we might have application type questions. Okay, so if you know the definition and you can pick it out of a scenario, now imagine that you are a therapist or you are a teacher or whatever it might be. Tell me how you would apply this particular concept. And I tend to do a lot of questions sort of building up like that, where the first thing they need to do is acquire just general understanding of the concept and then working their way up and saying, okay, if you really understand this concept, you can apply it. You can compare this concept to another concept. So really going back and asking, looking first at course objectives, what I want students to be able to do, and then writing questions that will get them to do those sorts of things.
Okay, thank you. What would be the pros and cons of adopting this approach? If somebody listening finds it interesting, thinks, well, I might want to do that, what would you say are the pros and the cons of it?
Right. Well, the pros, I think, one of the reasons I really like inner teaching is that the whole idea of creating this particular method was to start first and foremost with what you want your students to be able to do. And so looking at the kinds of things that we would, you know, lots of teachers would like their students to do, well, we would like them to read and think about the material before they come to class. We would like them to discuss with other students and debate a little bit and go back and forth and maybe argue a little bit on what a particular answer is. We would like them to ask questions maybe a little bit more proactively than they might otherwise. And, you know, even if we're thinking about our typical lecture class, you know, one of the things we would love for them to do is always be paying attention to us. And, you know, one of the things that I like about inner teaching is that because of the targeted focus of the lectures, there's probably a greater chance that students are going to be paying attention because the things that they asked us to go over are the thing, or that we're going over the things they've asked us to go over. So, you know, one, conceptually, it's built around the idea of what do we want students to be able to do during and after they're done with our classes. The other argument I would make is that, you know, now that there is a growing research body on this particular method, the results are pretty consistently positive. And so now if you're looking for something where you can say, well, I would like to use an evidence-based teaching method, you know, this is one of several that are out there. So I think those are definitely pros, major pros. I think a few other things that I like the fact that it gets students talking. You know, especially if we have a little bit larger classes, we may have a good chunk of students who do very little interacting during the course of a class, and now in our classes, they're at the very least talking to other students. I like the fact that when students are having their discussions, I can walk around and I can listen in. I know exactly what they're getting and what they're not getting. I don't have to guess about about what to include in my lecture because they're telling me, please go over these things. I like the fact that in addition to kind of knowing where they are, this gives me a great opportunity to get to know my students a little bit better, to develop some rapport. I can walk around, you know, not only can I ask them a few questions about how the class is going, but I can, you know, joke around and establish some of that rapport that I think is so important for them enjoying the class and being willing to put in the time necessary to do the work you're asking them to do. In terms of cons, I think a few of the things that people need to be aware of is that it's different. It's a different teaching method. And if we have students who are very used to coming to lecture-based classes and taking notes and then, you know, going home and maybe a few days before an exam, opening up the notes and cramming for an exam, now all of a sudden when you're asking them to do something different, there are a few who will say, why are you making me do this? I can get good grades on my own. Why are you making me do this additional work? Another thing is, so students buying into it, and I have to tell them, you know, at the very beginning of the semester and then several times throughout, just remember, trust me, you know, I'm asking you to do it for these reasons, and I'm very clear on why I'm doing this. I even will, you know, show them some of the data from our studies saying, you know, here's some evidence that it works. Another con is that it takes time to prepare. I think like any teaching method, when you're putting together a brand new class, it takes time. And if you are thinking that I'm going to read about this on a Friday and have your class planned out by a Monday, it's probably not going to happen. You know, it takes a good chunk of time. The first time that I ever used it was during a summer course where I taught over the course of, I think, 5 or 6 weeks. And in terms of putting together the preparation guides, I was literally hours ahead of my students.
Wow.
You know, so it takes a little bit of time to do that. But another pro related to that is once you have the class fairly structured, there's not a lot of deviation in what you're going to get from semester to semester. And so I would say that in the long run, it maybe takes a little bit less preparation time than what you might have otherwise.
Mm-hmm.
There's no more guessing about what students want you to go over. And in fact, after you've taught a class a number of times, you can have a pretty good idea of what they're going to have questions about ahead of time.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, for example, if I'm teaching research methods right now, which I've taught every year for a million years, you know,
yeah,
I know
me too.
I can predict exactly what questions they're going to have. And the nice thing about that is that if they turn in a record sheet and they say, you know, please go over these three questions, and one question that I know they typically struggle with is not one that's been on the record sheet a lot, I can include it anyway, knowing that they probably misunderstood part of it. So I think that's a very, you know, good part of one of the pros, again, of inner teaching.
Can I interrupt you and ask a question there? Do you, just because I imagine that people listening to this might ask, how, okay, because if you're reusing the preparation guides, you know, over time, do you have concern that those preparation guides are out and so now I'm just going to Xerox it from my friend and then bring that to class?
I'm not necessarily, because the preparation guides are just simply the questions.
Okay.
And what I usually do is I will go around. So if they get a prep guide that they saw from last semester, that's absolutely fine.
Okay.
What I frequently do is I will go around and I will check to make sure that they've answered the questions. And there are a couple different ways. I recently wrote an article that was in the APS Observer, the online teaching tips column, where I kind of laid out 10 tips for effective implementation, where I mentioned, you know, here's what the regular method is, but here are some things that I've come across in my time using inner teaching that people may want to be aware of. And one of those is, in the original article, Phil Heinlein and his colleague Ted Boyce said that preparation or prep guide completion should very often be taken care of by the fact that students don't want to show up and be the unprepared person.
Mm-hmm.
And I think to some extent that might be the case, especially if you're telling students to work with different people, you know, quite frequently. They don't want to be the one who shows up and make another student angry because they're not ready.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, I think it's fairly safe to assume that if somebody doesn't show up, another student is going to let it go.
Mm-hmm.
And so one of the things that I will do is I will go around and I will, I've heard a couple of different things that people do. They will, if possible, stand at the door and grab a couple of random students and say, let me see if you're done. And if they're done, they can come on in. And if they're not done, then their ticket of admission to the classroom is taken away. I know that Phil Heinlein has done it in the past. The thing that I do, and my students actually came up with this a couple of years ago, is I go around and I randomly choose a few people, and I say that if you are done, every day that you show up and do a discussion and turn in a record sheet, you get a very small number of participation points, sort of as a motivator to come to class. And I say, if you're done, you're good, and if you're not, you lose your participation points. And so I'm not saying that that completely takes care of the problem, because there may be a student here or there who I miss. But in general, I think that does a pretty decent job. And I tell students, look, it's my discretion to look at your answers. You can't just have a couple of things scribbled down. I need to see that you took some time to think about these things.
But what
it's kind of funny.
Oh, go ahead. I'm sorry.
I was just going to say it's funny because when I even at times will call out students' names before class and I'll say, here are the 10 of you. I want you to bring your answers up here. And students get excited when they're actually done and they get to come up and show me that they finished.
Uh-huh. Yeah, but what I'm hearing is that really, though, the meat of this is the in-class discussion and what they come up with and then what they demonstrate they understand and what they don't understand and then let you know, rather than the work they do in advance. So even if I got the answers in advance, it's more about discussing it with my peers. Am I misunderstanding you there or no?
Right. No, I think that's correct, because you know I tell them you're going to have to take some time to prepare ahead of time, because if you don't prepare, think about it like this: if you don't prepare, then you and your partner are going to be stuck just staring at each other, and you're going to get nothing out of it. Mm-hmm. And I tell them, think about it like this: if you don't show up prepared, and let's say your partner is, then you have effectively turned your discussion into a lecture. And the person who's lecturing to you, I can guarantee you, doesn't know the material as well as I do. Mm-hmm. So unless you show up prepared and you have that discussion, then you know there's something about the discussion that seems to make it stick. Mm-hmm. So have your discussions, then if you get stuck, you can call us over. But if you're sitting there, you know, I guess the idea is it takes two people to have a conversation. And if you aren't having, if you're not involved in that conversation, number one, it's going to be awkward, and number two, I can almost guarantee that you're not going to do as well.
And how does the interteaching, the preparation guides, the report sheets, how does that relate back to your assessments, your exams that you're giving them in class?
The prep guides are very much so the exams that I give, one of the recommendations in the original interteaching article is to try to have, if possible, I know this isn't always possible, but try to have a fairly large number of exams. So they recommend 4 or 5. Now, I know, again, that that's hard to do in some classes, but I try to have, you know, 4 or 5 exams in my class, and part of the idea is that it gives you plenty of opportunity to show what you know. And so Boyce and Heinlein in the original article even said, if you have 5 exams, drop one. That way if students start off and they have one of those days or whatever, you know, it gives them plenty of opportunity to show you what they know. But as far as the makeup of the exams, they are very strongly tied to the prep guides. So what I've done in the past is if I have, let's say, for example, an exam that maybe has an essay question or two on it, and a number of, like in research methods, an essay question or two, and then a number of more objective types of answers where they have a scenario and they have to pick out independent and dependent variables, that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
The essay questions will often be conceptual questions that may come almost word for word from the prep guide. So now this is not simply remembering a list of things. You have to talk through your answer. You have to understand conceptually what the answer to this particular question is, and then on the exam, you have to be able to write that and articulate that you understand this particular idea. So it's very strongly tied. Now, that doesn't mean necessarily that every question is going to come word for word from the prep guides.
Mm-hmm.
Some people will be, you know, concerned that, well, they're just memorizing these answers. Well, I think if you write some of the conceptual questions in the right way, then it's sort of hard for them just to remember an answer or a list. Then with regard to the more objective types of questions, I will frequently, so I also, for example, teach psychology of learning. A prep guide might have several examples of positive reinforcement on it, and then you can bet that the exam will also have examples of positive reinforcement, but different ones.
Mm-hmm.
So now they can be guaranteed that if they're answering questions on a prep guide about positive reinforcement or stimulus control or, you know, random assignment in a research methods class, they will see questions over those concepts, but it's not necessarily going to be the same word-for-word ideas.
Mm-hmm.
And so the rationale for that is give them practice talking about what you want them to know and then giving them related sorts of questions. Because if they learned it and if they discussed it effectively during the discussions, then they should be able to write about it effectively when exam time comes around.
Mm-hmm.
And the way that I tell them about it is, you know, my analogy is you go to a job interview and they tell you, oh, you're hired. When you show up on your first day of the job, we're going to ask you to know A, B, and C. And then you show up and they go, just kidding, you have to do these other things. And so my analogy is then when you show up, when you practice on a prep guide, it's sort of like being there for the job interview and being told, this is what I want you to know. And then when the exam rolls around, you can be guaranteed that those are the things I'm going to ask you to know.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the same sort of thing. If you give them lots of examples of concepts on prep guides, and then you put a related but novel example on an exam, if they really understand that concept and you've written your questions correctly, then they'll be able to show that on the exam. And that just takes away their ability just to memorize an answer.
Yeah, yeah. Well, at the same time, I imagine also validates the importance of the work they're doing during the interteaching
right.
exercise.
Absolutely. I tell them that what you're doing is during that. Just I had a conversation today with a few of my students. I said, what you're doing is you're practicing,
mm-hmm.
and then when you get to the exam, show me what you've practiced. You've practiced riding a bike. Now when the exam rolls around, I'm putting the bike in front of you and saying, show me if you can ride it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Nice. I'm wondering if you wouldn't mind if you would give us a sample prep guide and a sample report sheet that we could
sure.
Post along with this podcast. I think that people, you know, seeing that concretely, even though it's not in their discipline, I think that would be useful if you wouldn't mind.
No problem. I would be happy to send you.
Okay.
I've actually, so any particular class, I have methods, I have learning, I have a variety of other things. Those are some of the major classes I teach.
No,
I also have one. I'm not.
Go ahead.
Just one in particular?
Yeah.
Any particular?
I'm just thinking one that would really like represent maybe like what you were saying about Bloom's taxonomy. So one that really
sure.
kind of shows building it up and that you just think is an ideal guide. Because, you know, people listen from all different disciplines, but I think it would be nice just to see concretely,
yeah.
okay, what does
yeah.
this look like?
One thing I do, too, I'll send you this one as well. When I sometimes will give workshops or I'll talk about interteaching, there's actually an interteaching article that Tracy and I wrote for the Psychology Teachers Network where I actually have created a prep guide over that interteaching article. And I actually use this on the first day of class. So what I'll have students do is they'll practice doing interteaching by reading and discussing an interteaching article. And so what I've tried to do on that prep guide is have a variety of questions. So now not only are they getting used to the process, but they're actually learning about interteaching as they're doing it.
Excellent.
So that one's been a useful one. I'll send you that one as well.
Excellent. Thank you very much. As we wrap up, I guess the last question that I'd ask is, you know, being interested in the scholarship of teaching and learning and being interested in faculty development, you know, I get a lot sometimes of, oh, this is just the new hot trend in education or this is the new buzzword. So how would
right.
you respond to those who hear this and just say, okay, this is the new flavor of the month or this is the new buzzword?
Right, right. Well, I think part of it is the fact that the original article on interteaching was written in 2002, and here we are 11 years later, and the only thing that I'm seeing when I look in the literature is an increasing number of studies that are being done on this particular teaching method. I think, if anything, in what I'm seeing is that it's catching on. I'm getting more and more emails and more requests to come and give talks about interteaching and that sort of thing. And I think it might be hard to completely dismiss something that, number one, it seems to be fairly conceptually strong, and then, number two, has a good amount of data to support it. So, you know, who knows necessarily. I think there are teaching methods that they come out, people get very excited about them, but for a variety of reasons, you know, they eventually fall by the wayside. But at this point, I think if it were, you know, just a flash in the pan, we wouldn't be seeing this sort of growing trend in the amount of research that is being done on it and the number of people who seem to be using it. So I think those are good signs at least. I guess I couldn't predict what might happen within the next, you know, let's say 5 to 10 years, but I think that, like I said, conceptually it makes sense, and with some tips on implementation, the people I know who have started using it in their classes are seeing very positive results. I just got an email about a week ago, from a person who attended a talk of mine from, think it was the College of Worcester, and went back and told his colleagues all about it, and everybody in his department is starting to use some variation of it.
Hmm.
So yeah, I think those are good signs that people are picking up on it and giving it a try at the very least.
Well, thank you very much for exposing us to it. I certainly appreciate your time. I know you're busy, so thank you very much for your time.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Thanks for listening to this installment of Teaching, Learning, and Everything Else. For more information, please visit our website at cat.xula.edu. That's cat.xula.edu. Until next time, this is Elizabeth Yost-Hammer.